Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined today by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
So today we will continue our two-part series on the current state of the OECD's two-pillar project. In our last episode, we explored the current state of Pillar 1. Today's focus is on Pillar 2, the initiative intended to ensure that multinational enterprises pay their fair share of tax wherever they operate through the introduction of a global minimum corporate tax rate. For our discussion today, we're again joined by a friend of the podcast, Michael Plougin, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, and recently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Tax Affairs at the Treasury Department. That's a mouthful. But we're very excited to welcome Michael back to the podcast. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Gary. Great to be back.
So today we're diving back into the topic of Pillar 2, a topic that we've discussed many times on this podcast. However, since our last Pillar 2 discussion, a lot has changed. The pace of jurisdictions incorporating Pillar 2 in their local legislation has rapidly accelerated, and we're now in 2024, with many countries having rules that are currently in effect. We're also halfway through 2024, so closer to potential UTPRs coming into effect as well. So given all the changes recently, let's start by discussing the current state of Pillar 2 and provide just an update as to where things currently stand since we last discussed this topic. Michael, what trends are we seeing in Pillar 2 adoption right now?
Really, the top line point here is that Pillar 2 is here. 40 plus jurisdictions have enacted at least one of the rules with respect to Pillar 2. The EU member states are all either have adopted or are adopting Pillar 2 rules. The UK, Japan, Korea, et cetera, most of the US's major trading partners have adopted Pillar 2. And an even greater number of jurisdictions have adopted the QDMTT, the Qualified Domestic Minimum Top-Up Tax, including a number of previously zero tax jurisdictions. So Bermuda was a recent one that announced a new, effectively, QDMTT in its jurisdiction. So a lot of these rules apply from 2024. An even greater number of jurisdictions expected to come online in 2025. So this is an issue that taxpayers are currently grappling with and looking to deal with all the compliance issues that are going to come out of that over the next year to 2 years.
Thanks, Michael. So it definitely sounds like there's been a lot of progress towards global Pillar 2 implementation. But with that being said, as of now, there doesn't seem to be an immediate path for the U.S. to enact the GLOBE rules. If I'm a U.S. multinational entity, why should I care about these rules?
Right. Yeah, you're right that the U.S. has not implemented Pillar 2 rules, but the rules are still very relevant for U.S. multinationals. So if a U.S. multinational has operations in a jurisdiction with a QDMTT, then it has to comply with those rules. There are also a lot of structures where a U.S. multinational has a holding company in a jurisdiction that has implemented the IIR, like Ireland. So if you've got subsidiaries, low-tax subsidiaries underneath Ireland, then those subsidiaries would be subject to Ireland's IIR and top-up tax in Ireland. And so that's a today issue. Those are issues that arise in 2024. In addition, down the road, the UTPR kicks in 2025 in a number of jurisdictions. And that can apply to low tax profits in the U.S. However, there's a UTPR safe harbor that would apply until 2026 to protect U.S. profits of U.S. headquartered multinationals. So the UTPR has not kicked in yet, but it is coming down the road.
So one thing that's been discussed a lot lately is that low-tax countries may adopt a QDMTT in order to be compliant with the globe rules, but then at the same time create additional incentives to give back the tax revenue that they collect to taxpayers. This type of refund would seem to undermine the globe rules and the entire Pillar 2 system. So, Michael, is there any backstop that would prevent this type of thing from occurring? So, for example, could giving back the revenue potentially render a QDMTT a non-qualified domestic minimum top-up tax?
Yes, there actually is. There's a rule that says that if a country has enacted a QDMTT, it cannot provide a benefit that is, quote, related to the domestic minimum top-up tax. And if it does, that means that the domestic minimum top-up tax would not be a QDMTT. But it's not really clear exactly what the consequences of that would be under the rules more generally.
So it seems like these type of incentives could undercut the entire purpose of Pillar 2. How does the OECD view these incentives? Could these type of incentives be seen somehow as consistent with the goals of Pillar 2?
Well, it's actually a really hard policy question, in my view. You know, sometimes you've got questions where the policy is really clear, and it's a question of how do you implement it? How do you avoid unintended consequences? That sort of thing. But I think this is actually a really difficult policy question for Pillar 2. But here's how I think about it. As a practical matter, Pillar 2 can't police government spending, and it was never about policing government spending. And in fact, some people have said that as a policy matter, changing where investment incentives are located from being tax incentives to being sort of explicit direct subsidies or direct spending, that direct spending is better because it's more transparent and the political economy of that is better. But in any event, you need a dividing line between, again, government spending, which Pillar 2 cannot police, and quote unquote bad tax incentives. And so what the Pillar 2 negotiators came up with is to look at financial accounting and the idea that refundable tax credits are more like government spending, like direct subsidies, and that non-refundable tax credits are really just tax benefits. So that's how you ended up with this qualified refundable tax credit versus other types of tax credits distinction in the Pillar 2 rules. But I think non-refundable credits can also be viewed as subsidies. And in fact, in the US, we talk about them as tax expenditures. And so to some extent, that distinction in the rules is a bit arbitrary. I think a more fundamental goal of Pillar 2 is about base erosion and profit shifting and trying to prevent the incentives that lead to base erosion and profit shifting. And I think viewing it through that lens can lead to a more coherent distinction in types of tax incentives, which is to say that incentives that are designed to attract profit, like a zero rate or a benefit tied to the amount of profit in a jurisdiction, like a patent box, for example, those are pretty clearly contrary to the policy goals of Pillar 2. Whereas government subsidization of activity in a jurisdiction by providing a tax incentive based on a percentage of the expenditures in the jurisdiction with respect to that activity, I don't think that really undermines the policy goals of Pillar 2. Now, there are still very difficult lines to draw there, but to me, that at least provides a framework for thinking about protecting the Pillar 2 policy goals in the face of tax incentives.
Thanks, Michael. So one other question that comes up, we've talked a lot about QDMTTs, and one question that comes up is, how are they going to determine whether a country has a qualified domestic minimum tax? And then the follow-up question that you think about is, well, what is the consequence of being a non-qualified domestic minimum tax? Michael, can you shed some light on that?
Sure. So the way that they're going to determine, you know, whether a country has a qualifying DMTT, QDMTT, it's going to be a peer review process. And we don't have any guidance at this stage about how that's going to work, but they have said publicly many times that we should expect to at least get guidance as to which jurisdictions have QDMTTs later this year. And the reason that's important is that for Pillar 2, it's really all about rule order. If there's a QDMTT, then that will reduce or offset or completely turn off any top-up tax under an IIR. And if there's a qualifying IIR, then that completely turns off the UTPR. So you have to know, in order to apply the rules in the proper order, you know, which countries have qualifying top-up taxes. Now, there are a couple of different buckets of QDMTT. So there's a QDMTT safe harbor, and if the domestic minimum top-up tax qualifies for that safe harbor, then it turns off the IIR and the UTPR completely. If the QDMTT does not qualify for the safe harbor, but it still has a Q, then any tax collected under the QDMTT is credited on a dollar-for-dollar basis against the IIR or UTPR. So still a significant benefit. And then if the domestic top-up tax does not have a Q, as I alluded to earlier, we don't really know what the consequence of that would be, and it probably depends on why it's not qualifying. But my assumption is that in that case, it's likely to be a covered tax because it's going to be an income tax. And so I think that at least will provide some coverage or protection against application of the IIR and UTPR in any event.
So many QDMTTs. There's a DMTT, a QDMTT, and I believe a QQDMTT.
Right.
They haven't used it yet, but get ready for it. So, Michael, as you hinted before, the treatment of refundable versus non-refundable tax credits is really important under the model rules and the guidance that's come out. Basically, refundable tax credits treated as cash grant increases globe income, but a non-refundable tax credit, while it's not treated as income, it reduces covered taxes. And you know, I don't want to go through all the formulas, but at the end of the day, a reduction of covered taxes is worse for you than an increase to your globe income. And so the R&D credit is our most well-known non-refundable tax credit. And this R&D credit and other general business credits threaten to throw a lot of U.S. multinationals into a lower ETR and potentially subject to globe. And so this becomes particularly important when UTPRs come online, which could subject the U.S. to the UTPRs of their foreign affiliates. So there's been some talk recently on some panels that the OECD has at least given some thought to revisiting this refundable versus non-refundable credit distinction. Is there any chance that there's some movement at the OECD that could possibly give U.S. M&Es some relief on their non-refundable R&D credits?
Well, as you say, this is a huge issue for U.S. taxpayers. It's a really significant bipartisan issue in Congress. It's also a top priority for Treasury and the administration in these negotiations. So I don't want to overstate where we are. And as I said, as you said, the qualified refundable tax credit versus other types of credits distinction is a fundamental rule in the Pillar 2 model rules. And it's something that's been around for a long time. It was in the 2020 blueprint on Pillar 2. And so countries are very attached to that. So I do think it's going to be very difficult to get a change here. But I do think there are reasons for hope. For one, as I explained, I think that from a policy perspective, a non-refundable tax credit can properly be viewed as a subsidy for the expenditures in that jurisdiction. And I really don't think that credits that are designed that way, like the U.S. R&D credit, undermine the policy goals of Pillar 2. They're not an incentive that incentivizes profit shifting among jurisdictions. I also think that there are allies for the U.S. on this issue. And lots of countries incentivize R&D through non-refundable tax credits or super deductions. And so I think that there will be natural allies in the discussion at the inclusive framework. And actually, in that regard, last year in a report by the OECD to the G20, there's a statement saying that the inclusive framework will need to work on safe harbors to address the impact of tax incentives for R&D in the context of talking about developing countries and the impact of Pillar 2 on developing countries. So there's already a hook in the inclusive framework to have these discussions, but it's something that a lot of countries are very attached to. Now, I think we need to be careful here, because even if there is additional guidance at the inclusive framework that provides favorable treatment for the R&D credit, it's pretty clear that the EU directive to implement Pillar 2 is not going to change in the near future. Just politically, that's going to be extremely difficult for them to do. And so to be effective, there really needs to be an interpretation of the existing rules of the EU directive or a safe harbor, because the EU directive has a dynamic interpretation of safe harbors. And so if it can be couched in the form of a safe harbor, that's going to be an effective way to get those changes in the rules.
Thanks, Michael. And so this brings us to talk a little bit more about the UTPR, which again is really important to US M&Es. So a handful of countries have enacted a UTPR that go into effect in 2025, while other countries are at least contemplating the adoption of one. As we noted earlier, due to the UTPR safe harbor, US M&Es generally don't have to worry about the UTPR as it applies to US income through 2025 for calendar year taxpayers. However, while not an immediate issue, this is something US M&Es really need to begin to prepare for. Michael, should US M&Es be concerned? And do you think there's a possibility that the US can shield itself from a UTPR forever? Or is this safe harbor going to end soon and no longer benefit us?
Well, the way I think about it is that the UTPR is really a backstop rule. The best result for everybody is if the UTPR never applies. The reason for the rule, really, there are two reasons. The first reason for the rule was to prevent inversions, right? So the idea is if you've got countries implementing an IIR, that could cause multinationals to try to re-headquarter in a different jurisdiction to avoid the application of the IIR. And the UTPR is meant to address those concerns. The other reason, frankly, that it was adopted was to deal with concerns about some countries not participating, and in particular in the U.S., that took the form of concerns over the possibility that China would not implement and differences in competitiveness for Chinese multinationals. And the UTPR is intended to address that. Certainly, my hope is that the UTPR never applies to U.S. profits. And the question is really, what are the options to achieve that? So I think you were suggesting sort of option one is to extend the UTPR safe harbor beyond 2025. I think that is a possibility. I think other countries, though, are really concerned about, for the same reasons that the UTPR exists in the first place, they're concerned about giving a competitive advantage to U.S. multinationals by saying, okay, you don't have to be subject to the same 15% rate that other countries are subject to. And one response to that is, well, maybe the U.S. could punch other countries in the mouth and threaten them and say, if you don't extend the UTPR safe harbor, then we're going to do something bad to you. And maybe that will work, but I do think we ought to be careful and inquiry whether that invites retaliation from other countries, especially the EU in this case, and would that lead to an escalating tax and trade war? I think that's a legitimate possibility, and I think that's probably not in the interest of business. I think the second option, and this is a difficult option, I recognize, as we just talked about, but getting a fix for the R&D credit at the inclusive framework, and by R&D credit, I actually mean all general business credits in the US, and getting a fix for that at the inclusive framework. And as we talked about, that's difficult, but not impossible in my view. But it's only a partial solution because, as we talked about, it might be difficult for EU member states to implement that different guidance because of the directive at the EU level. So a more complete solution along those lines would be for the U.S. to also have a domestic top-up tax that protects the R&D credit and other U.S. credits and have that recognized as a QDMTT that's eligible for a safe harbor. Now, you might even combine that with a punch them in the mouth approach, but putting those two things together provides an off-ramp for everybody and maybe allows us to avoid the kinds of tax and trade wars that might otherwise arise.
You mentioned the possibility of adopting a QDMTT in the U.S. That doesn't seem likely in the near term. In fact, the U.S. doesn't seem poised to adopt Pillar 2 at all. However, considering the rapidly changing Pillar 2 landscape, I've heard that there's elections in November and the looming expiration of many of the individual tax-reducing provisions of the TCJA. At the end of 2025, there's definitely a possibility that the tax world could look a lot different. Indeed, some folks are calling 2025 the Super Bowl of tax. Those are very boring people. If the U.S. were to consider adopting a Pillar 2 compliant regime in 2025 or later, what would that look like?
First of all, I should say the odds of Congress cutting and pasting the model rules for Pillar 2 is zero. That's just not going to happen. But I do think there is a chance to do some Pillar 2 type reforms, Pillar 2 consistent reforms to existing rules in the U.S. So, for example, and this was something that we saw in proposed Build Back Better bill, you could reform GILTI to make it country by country with at least a 15% rate. And there's some question as to whether that would be treated as a qualified IIR for Pillar 2 purposes, but that was really the deal in 2021, that as long as GILTI was country by country at a 15% rate, other countries would say that's good enough. That's probably likely to still be the case. The administration has proposed replacing the BEAT with the UTPR. I think that's harder given the differences there, given that the UTPR is based on deferred tax accounting. Could they get closer to the UTPR? Sure. But actually, the UTPR really needs to be very consistent across jurisdictions to work properly and avoid double tax. So that one seems pretty difficult to me. Then lastly, as we just talked about, could the U.S. adopt a QDMTT? Again, I don't think there's any chance that the Congress is going to cut and paste the rules for a QDMTT. That's just not in the cards. I think the best result here would be to reform or replace CAMTI to have a top-up tax that applies to U.S. profits at a 15% based on book that protects the R&D credit, protects other general business credits in the U.S. And again, I think that would require a fix at the inclusive framework to say that that favorable treatment of the R&D credit is okay.
A loyal listener of the podcast continuously sends me emails saying, when are we going to talk about the United Nations? So this is the moment that he's been waiting for. So recently, the UN has injected itself into the BEPS 2.0 conversation. Specifically, late last year, the UN approved a proposal to begin developing a framework convention on international tax cooperation. The advocates for this proposal, mostly developing countries, complain that the OECD's two-pillar solution primarily protects the interests of developed countries at the expense of developing countries. Michael, what's the complaint here, and what does this mean for the future of OECD's work on tax cooperation generally and the Pillar 2 work specifically?
So as I understand it, the complaint by developing countries comes down to a couple of things. One is that the inclusive framework is not actually inclusive. If I put the most generous spin on it, the complaint is that non-OECD members are at the inclusive framework not by right, but by invitation of the OECD members. And so it's not their home, if you will. On the other hand, everyone at the inclusive framework participates on an equal footing in the terminology of the OECD, which means that everyone is part of the decision-making process, and any country can block an action by objecting to it. So all decisions are taken by consensus. If one country objects to it, then the action doesn't happen. Now, I think developing countries are also very concerned because they feel like that's not a real consensus, because the Secretariat provides documents really late with a short turnaround, primarily in English. And so countries don't really have the opportunity to consider what it is they're providing consent to. That's a problem for the United States, actually, in this process. And these are documents in our native language, and we've got, you know, significant resources to handle that. I can certainly understand that complaint from a developing country perspective. Other complaint is that at the inclusive framework, the agenda has really been set by the developed economies, the OECD members, in the BEPS project, and then through some of the G20 mechanisms as well. Now, I will say that in my experience, there are several developing countries in the steering group of the inclusive framework who are influential in setting the agenda for the steering group and the inclusive framework. So that one is maybe less sympathetic in my view, just based on what I've seen. Now, in terms of what does this mean for the OECD and tax cooperation, clearly the UN has staked out a larger role for itself in the tax sphere. They are going to establish a framework tax convention that sets up a UN body to discuss international tax standards and create binding international tax treaties. That's just clearly going to happen. I think that you're right to focus on the OECD response and what happens there. With respect to Pillar One, there's clearly a tension between the Pillar One work and the UN negotiations because they're both a reallocation of taxing rights. I don't think it's consistent to have a Pillar One deal with the UN negotiations going on at the same time. I just really think that the UN negotiations undermine that. I think with respect to Pillar Two, there's less direct conflict. And there are actually several developing countries that have implemented QDMTTs and are looking at other pieces of Pillar Two as well. So I don't think that they necessarily directly conflict. On the other hand, you do hear a lot of developing countries worried about the complexity of Pillar Two. And I think that some of the discussion at the UN is about what they view as simpler tools to claim their taxing rights, things like withholding taxes. And I do think that there is an interaction where you could see developing countries go more with the UN model as opposed to the Pillar Two type of rules.
Thanks, Michael. We need to wrap this episode up, but before we conclude, any final thoughts on where Pillar Two is heading?
Again, I think the top line takeaway is that Pillar Two is here. Countries are implementing. One of the key things that we talked about is the potential application of the UTPR to U.S. profits. And that's really, I think, a key question for U.S. multinationals. And in my view, it would be really good if we can avoid a tax and trade war over Pillar Two. And I think the best way to accomplish that goal is for the U.S. to enact some Pillar Two consistent reforms, while then also working with other countries to ensure that the other countries' rules work with the U.S. to make sure that the system works properly. Now, regardless, there will continue to be a need for multilateral cooperation to address issues under Pillar Two. And so some of the things that the inclusive framework is working on now are dispute resolution mechanisms, including potentially looking at a multilateral convention in that regard. I think they're going to have to continue issuing administrative guidance to clarify some of the issues and make sure that there's a consistent interpretation around the world to avoid the kinds of double taxation that could otherwise arise.
So thank you, Michael, for joining us today to discuss where things stand with respect to Pillar Two. And a special thanks to Casey Caldwell for helping with this episode of the podcast. Things are clearly progressing in this space, with many countries having already implemented the Pillar Two rules. And based on our discussion today, it's clear there's still more to come. So definitely something we'll continue to keep an eye on in the weeks and months ahead. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.